to talk a little bit about modern crypto system types and their functions. And there are various systems we're going to talk about. Just a nice little analogy here. You can think of crypto systems like blenders. Okay? So the idea is to get a good mix. And if you think about decryption, decryption is like taking this cake mix, it's all mixed up and it's ready to go, and then unmixing it all so that the eggs and their yolks are back together and the butter is back in stick form and all the others. And that's what it is. That's how it works. You mix it up, and then when you unmix it, so if you did it really well, all right, so now we know that it's very difficult, if not impossible. Suppose we blended up a cake mix and then took out a tablespoonful of that cake mix, all blended, ready to go. We took that out and we said, that's the signature for those ingredients. Okay, this is like what an MD5, a message digest is. Okay, because that spoonful, if you taste it, it tastes like, you know, mom's cake. And if somebody else makes the cake, their spoonful, after you mix it, won't taste like mom's. It'll taste like somebody else's. And that difference in taste is the same as looking at the crypto checksum and saying, yeah, it's mom, or no, it's somebody else. That's amazing, isn't it? And think about now, if you only had that spoonful, well, you couldn't decrypt it somehow into the original ingredient. You couldn't find mom. And yet the taste proves to you that it is mom. So that's the notion. It's a blender. All right, so the DES, Data Encryption Standard, is a crypto system that was created, must be 20 years ago, for the purpose of securing federal information and processing and anybody else that wanted to secure cryptographic storage and communication. And it was, at the time it was created, it was noted that it had 56 bit keys, and according to the analysis, I guess it was by Adi Shamir, the increase in computing power, a decrease in computing cost, and increase in memory over the next 15 years would cause it to get to a point where you could exhaustively search the DES key space for about $1 million. And lo and behold, they approved the standard knowing that and having stated that. And son of a gun, 15 years later, was the first about, the first time it was sort of cracked in that way. Maybe it was 20 years later, I don't remember the exact date. And, you know, just as the numbers predicted, and son of a gun, they decertified it just about the time when people were able to crack it. So it's no longer certified, but everybody still used it. Let's see, the DES, we talked about Shannon's theory and confusion and diffusion and their role in making all this stuff work. So basically what happens with the DES is it uses both confusion and diffusion. In fact, what it does is permutations and substitutions. It has permutation boxes that basically, if you take each bit as if it was on an incoming wire, it just trades it with some other wire. And well, actually, it might get a shift, or every incoming wire gets hooked to some outcoming wire in a pseudo-random pattern. Actually, it's a very well-structured pattern. It has to be because it's necessary that it's a one-to-one onto mapping. That is, every input has a unique output wire associated with it. Otherwise, they would get mixed up, and you would never be able to decode it. Note the hint, never be able to decode it. That would be a good thing for message digest, right? Okay, that's how they diffuse the bits, right? They spread the bits across the space of the cryptogram, both the bits of the key and the bits of the message. And then there's substitution boxes. And the substitution boxes take the whole input, maybe it's an 8-bit input, and they map it into another 8-bit output. So that for every input number, there's a specific output number that gets generated. And so the way the DES works is it mixes the key with the plain text in a series of rounds of diffusion and confusion. They're called S boxes and P boxes. And it's a permutation box, and S is the substitution box. They do permutations and substitutions. They do a bunch of rounds of that. And then they do things like switching the left and right half and inserting another bit of the key here. And they schedule different parts of the key to come in different places. So that's basically what the DES is. Now, in case you thought I was going to tell you all about all the details of DES here today, you may feel relieved, because there's no way I'm going to do that. There are plenty of people who have done much better. In fact, we have here the Data Encryption Standard. on paper, which is, I guess, available off the web if you want it, from the U.S. Department of Commerce National Institute of Standards and Technology. So you can feel free to review it at your leisure and see exactly what the numbers are, what the substitutions and the permutations are in the PMF boxes. So that's all published, how the keys are scheduled and so forth. There it is. Let's see, DES uses a series of rounds of substitutions and permutations to do confusion and diffusion. It schedules the keys, the different subsets of the key with different transformations on it, get mixed in with the data along the way. It also has modes of operation. There's a standard mode where you take a key and you take 56-bit key and 64 bits of input, and you put them on the inputs and let the output is the answer. It gives you 64 bits of output. Or you can chain them together so that the output of this one helps to determine the output of the next one. So that every 64 bits you put in, every 8 bytes you put in, will generate a different 8 byte output depending on the sequence that came before it. Okay, for example, you could XOR the output of the previous round, of the previous encryption, those last 64 bits, with the incoming 64 bits as part of the additional encryption, and it would give you a different 64 output bits for the same 64 inputs in the first round. And that's essentially called cipher block chaining or cipher block feedback. So you take the cipher and as a block and you use that to feed back into the system. And there are some other modes. Probably get to them. So then there's the sort of extension of that is triple DES, also known as 3DES, 3DES. And so what you do with triple DES, conceptually, you take three DES boxes, each one with a different key, K1, K2, and K3. You put the plain text in the top, the ciphertext falls out the bottom, having been encrypted three different times with three different keys. That's essentially what it does. So there's an interesting question, and that is it actually better to have a 3DES than a single DES? And the answer is, drumroll, nobody knows. There are cases that you can figure out where P1 and P2 and P3 have some interaction so that it becomes, well, let's say the simple case is, suppose P1 and P2 just happen to be the same, pseudo-randomly generated. Well, then you've just decrypted in phase two what you encrypted in phase one, and it's no better than having a single key, K3. Okay? Another example is there are some keys that have special properties, so that the output transform is trivial. So it's very little change. There might be keys where P1 combined with P2 and P3 in the sequence will produce an output that's exactly the same as the original input. Okay? Or it might end up that it produces some other transform that's fairly trivial to undo. And nobody knows specifically all those things. So it's not at all clear that you get a better system by having three DESs than by having one DES. We do know it takes more time to do the encryption and decryption, but it might take less time to attack. We don't know that. Generally, people implement it just like that. You get a DES, and you put one key in each of the three copies of DES, and you run the output of one for the input of the next. So once you've got a DES, a three DES is pretty easy. Okay, this is the IDEA cipher, which is, if you think it's hard to read up here on the screen, it's even harder to read when you actually look at it, because it's just hard to read. I think I have a paper here on the IDEA cipher. I should have one. It's stuck over there somewhere. At the minimum, I had a sheet on it. Maybe if it's attached there somewhere to that one. Ah, here it is. Oh, sorry. These are the modes of the DES on this sheet. This is from a book, Handbook of Applied Cryptography, by Menezes and Ushot and Van Stone, or whoever I can't actually do. So that shows you the different ways that the DES gets connected together. And I thought I had the IDEA cipher picture here, but I don't. All right, so basically, the IDEA cipher takes 64-bit, that is 8-byte blocks, and 128-bit key, and it schedules 128-bit key
to do permutations and substitutions. We're going to start to hear the words a lot. Just like the DES, right? Those various permutations and substitutions, and encrypts the 64-bit blocks with 128-bit keys and produces an output, and you decode it in the same way as you encode it, basically. And you can't see it very well in the picture, but basically it shifts the left and the right half and does other substitutions and permutations. But there's no particularly specific reason you should think this is any better. It is faster than the DES, if that's good. That means maybe it's faster to encrypt, but it's faster to attack by testing the keys. But because it has 128-bit key space, it's harder to guess all the possibilities by a factor of 2 to the 64th than a 64-bit key, and DES only 56-bit key. It's quite a bit harder if you're going to just do exhaustive key search. It might be that there are weak keys. Various systems have weak keys. In fact, almost every system has weak keys. So if you happen across a weak idea key, like all zeros, for example, it might be a strong thing. So you get the idea. Joke.
The RSA is the Revist-Shamir Edelman crypto system, created by Revist and Shamir, actually, and not able to be broken by Edelman, and therefore a success. I don't remember which one it was, but basically the way they worked was Revist and Shamir created crypto systems and Edelman broke them. So Revist and Shamir created their first one and Edelman broke it. Created their second one and Edelman broke it. And I think it was like the 48 or whatever it was. You know, they created a whole bunch of them and Edelman kept breaking them. And finally they came across one and Edelman couldn't break it. At which point they declared it a success in public. So that's how we got the RSA crypto system. And it was a dual public key crypto system based on the complexity of factoring very large products of two very large prime numbers. Okay, it turns out that the factoring problem has been studied for a very long time, and it's been found very difficult to factor very large numbers if they're the products of two primes. Okay, now we all know how to factor primes, I hope, or else we're all in big trouble. So you know how to factor primes already. You know, so you take 10 and it's 2 times 5, right? So we factored that. So it seems pretty easy. But try and factor a, 200-digit product of two 100-digit primes, and it's not so easy. What happens is the two prime numbers combined with the modulus of this system form a ring structure, a mathematical ring structure. And what that means essentially is, in this case it's a ring, it's an exponential ring. So what it means is that if you take an input and you take it to the power of the encryption key, then it runs around the modulus. As you multiply it again and again and again to take the exponent, it'll pass the modulus many times and roll around, sort of like one of those things where you draw with multiple gears in a circle to make these pretty pictures. And eventually, if you keep going, it'll come around to where it started. The ring that's made by this guarantees that before you'll come around to where you started, you'll hit every number between 0 and the modulus before you'll ever come around that ring again. Okay? That's one of the natures of the system. So if you think of it, one direction, you're going around the ring a bunch of times where it stops. Nobody knows, bing, it stops. And to decrypt it, what you do is you go back around the ring the other way, and you do that by taking that answer to the power of the other key in the same modulus. Okay? What that means is that the two keys are inverses of each other relative to that modulus. Okay, so A to the encryption key taken to the decryption key, A to the power of encryption key taken to the power of decryption key in that modulus is equal to A. Now there are some cases you might want to be aware of. Like, what's 0 to any power? 0 to any power is 0. So if you encrypt all zeros with an RSA crypto system, it doesn't matter what the keys are, the answer is 0.
So this might be a problem.
That's what you'd want to know. So if you ever see an RSA encryption with the answer being zero, you know it's a plain text one. And the probability is one in, 10 to the however many digits it is. If it's a 128-digit key, one in 10 to 128 probability. Then you'll come across that message. Of course, the message space is not equally distributed, but that's another issue. All right, so you take the ciphertext is equal to the plain text taken to the exponent key encryption mod m to encrypt or to verify, and the plain text is the ciphertext to the decryption key power mod m. Is how you decrypt or assign things. It's a dual system that is whether I give you the encryption or decryption key, they do the same function. So I can pick either one and make it the encryption key and use the other one as the decryption key, or pick either one as the verification key and make key and make the other one the signature key. Okay. And so also we talk about them as public key, private key. So either key can be made the private key and the other one made the public key. The only problem is if you happen to give both of them away as public key, in which case you lose. The encryption and decryption have to be relatively prime in the modulus. If they weren't prime relative to each other in the modulus, then you wouldn't have this ring structure. The modulus is the product of two large primes. And so given that you have the modulus and the decryption key, that is supposed to imply that the encryption key is hard to find. And also given that you have the modulus and the encryption key, the decryption key is supposed to be hard to find. If that's true, then that makes it a reasonably good system as a public key system. So that's how it works and why it is the way it is. And for those of you that are interested in more on the RSA, we have here 20 years of attacks on the RSA crypto system by Dan Bonac, which I also found off the web. It's from the Notices of the American Mathematical Society, volume 46, number 2. And the really important thing to note about this from my perspective is not only does it list several different attack methods against the crypto system, it also fails to list several of the published attack methods against the crypto system. So it's not exactly definitive, but it might be interesting. Give you some ideas. MD5 is an example of a message digest. Why is it MD5? Well, MD1 didn't work very well. So the guy wrote MD2, and that didn't work very well. MD3 didn't work that well. MD4 seemed to work really well. It got published, got widely used, and then somebody figured out that it wasn't very strong. And they figured out a way to forge messages, so he came up with MD5, and so far nobody's complained about it. He's afraid of it, so he's working on MD6. So this is the fifth in the series. It's a one-way hash function. That is, the object is to detect change, to detect the difference between two inputs. So if I give you the input once, and I do an MD5 checksum of it, and I give you this what's supposed to be the same input the second time, and I do an MD5 checksum of it, the chances that they will produce the same checksum, if they are not in fact the same sequence of bits, is supposed to be very, very low. Okay? And so the problem, of course, is if two of them happen to be the same, if you have two different files and they happen to produce the same checksum, that would be bad. Okay. That would mean that I could make that change and you wouldn't be able to detect it. Now, it would be even worse if I could systematically create an input file that had most of the bits of my choosing and some of the bits generated by some algorithm that would produce the same checksum as any file that you started with. Because that would allow me to put in a Trojan horse in place of your original and you would not be able to detect it with the checksum. Or change the signature on a document, or amount of money in a transaction, or what have you. So it's a cryptographic checksum. You can think about it as, imagine you encrypt a document, and then you checksum. Okay, so it's encrypted, and then checksum. Same sort of thing. RSA would do great. Okay, you take an RSA, and for every block of plain text, you take that to the encryption key mod the modulus. You throw out the decryption key at creation, so nobody can ever have it. You take the first block of input, you take it to the exponent in the modulus. Then you start with that number, and you add the next block in the modulus, and take that to the exponent in the modulus, and keep doing that. And eventually, the final answer that you get out is very, very good. It depends on every input bit. it's run around this ring structure a lot of times. We can't even decrypt it if we have the public key, but if we start out the key, it's much harder. So this same sort of mechanism, the only problem is that the RSA has too low a performance. Right, we want to typically check some very large files very quickly. We want a message digest. We want to digest very large messages very quickly for the purposes of ensuring that they're unaltered. And an RSA takes, like a minute, a megabyte or something. It's very slow. So imagine doing a multi-gigabyte disk. It takes a very long time. So what this does is it breaks the message into blocks of some given size. And you can model it as a nonlinear feedback shift register. That is, if you push more bits in the front of it, they fall off the end and they get XORed into the other bits that are inside it, XORed or inverse XORed into it. Nonlinear because some of these can be knots. Some of them are not knots. Some are XORed and some are the knot of the XOR. And you then add constants and just keep going. So your result reads out this side and you keep shoving the bits in this way. And you can repeat from block after block and you print out the result. That's one way to think about it. It's not actually the algorithm they use, but we're not, so if you wanted to know the specifics of the algorithm they use, I have a paper off the web. Where is this guy from? MIT Laboratory for Computer Science and RSA Data Security Incorporated, April 92. Ron Rivest from the Network Working Group, request for comments, RFQ 1321. RFC 1321. So this is an internet RFC that specifies the MD5 message digest algorithm. And if you look through it, it includes a program that does it. And as most such programs, just like the DES, as most such programs, it has a whole bunch of magic numbers in it. If you look at the DES specification, you'll see these blocks of numbers, 17, 35, 12, 8. How did they choose those numbers? Well, the answer is how they chose the numbers turns out. The NSA and IBM combined together to create the DES originally. How they chose the numbers is classified. I think it's classified because they tossed a coin. They don't want anybody to know. But whatever the reason is, so same with these. How do they choose the numbers for this MD5 digest? Nobody knows. Who picked the numbers? There are numbers, okay. Feel free to read that paper and go, hey. By the way, if you've never read crypto papers, it's a real experience. Unrivaled in the annals of humanity is the experience of reading papers by cryptographers. There are lots and lots of other crypto systems. In fact, there are lots and lots and lots and lots of poor quality crypto systems out there, and daily use the rating of cryptanalysts to break them. So if you wanted to become a cryptanalyst and break other people's crypto systems, there are lots of them out there, and they are breakable, and they're available. Nobody even really knows how strong most of the widely published ones are. Nobody has any measure for how strong the MD5 checkpoint is. There are sort of measures. I think the measure of the MD5 checksum is out of the it generates a pseudo-random number given your input. Okay, so what the measure is, that if that's a 128-bit number, then the probability is 1 in 2 to 128, right, or about 1 in 10 to the 30th, that another file will produce the same thing. But we don't know that that's true. And furthermore, there's the birthday problem. And we talked about the birthday problem last time. Perfect time for the rest of the slide. We talked about the birthday problem last time. And the birthday problem means that the probability of, given that we have an n-bit checksum, the probability that two files chosen at random will have the same MD5 checksum is something like the square root of that. So it's only 1 in 2 to the 64th. So 2 to the 64th is about 10 to the 20th. How do I do that? Anybody know how to do that calculation? Yeah. 10 is 2 to the 3.2 or something. It's just the log base 2 of 10. So you divide by about 3.2 number of bits and you get the number of digits. Right? So 32 bits is about 10 digits. Makes sense, right? At any rate, about 20 digits, so 1 in 10 to the 20th, let's see, a billion in 10 to the 9th, trillion is 10 to the 12th, we're in trouble here. A quadrillion is 10 to the 15th, right? And a quintillion is 10 to the 18th. And nobody knows what comes after that. The point is, we don't have anything like that many different files out there. There's only 5 billion people in the world, give or take, right? So that's 10 to the 9th. So that means everybody would have to create 10 to the 12th files on average before we'd have enough files that we'd have to run across the birthday problem. Just a thought. All right. But still, nobody really knows the strength of it. There might be some trick to get around it. Secret crypto systems, of course, are used by many groups. Usually, they're easy to break if you know what you're doing and they don't know what they're doing. So if the guy that made it isn't a real bloody expert, and you are, then you can usually win. Usually, it's harder to figure out what you're breaking. That is, if it's a secret crypto system, it's a lot harder to figure out what it is the crypto system is that you're breaking. All you see is a stream of bits. You don't know anything about how they generated it. That's a lot tougher than if you get a hold of one of their boxes. And there are more coming day after day. Every day, people publish some new crypto system. And who knows how good they are? Elliptic curve, right? What's another one? I don't remember. So there are all sorts of algorithms. Nobody knows how good they are. I can come up with one tomorrow. In fact, I can come up right now, won't we? You take the number and written down as digits, you flip it upside down, and you encode it with a runlength code, and then you do an XOR with my key. And then, whatever you have, gobbledygook, all these numbers, you turn them into digits that you write down, you flip it upside down, you get the runlength code, then you XOR with my number again, you just keep doing that, 17 times, 17 rounds. Do it 17 times, and that's the output. It might be fantastic. This might be the greatest crypto system ever invented, and we would never know because I forgot to write it down. But I don't know what I did. Okay. So it's not hard to invent a crypto system, but it's pretty hard to invent a good crypto system. So I'm going to talk about hands-on cryptography today, and basically what you do for hands-on cryptography today is you install and learn how to operate modern crypto systems. Okay, so this is your job. In fact, I guess for the most part you do it. But consider this an assignment for your tenure here, is to install and learn to use PGP, DES, an MD5 fingerprint system for files, a small application with some simple embedded cryptography, a secure TCP tunnel, and a virtual private network. These are all things that are relatively easy to do. You just have to think about how to do them. Now, we have day-to-day crypto systems that we use all the time. Secure Shell is very commonly used between mostly Unix systems. You can get Secure Shell to run from Windows, but of course, since most Windows systems don't have X11, then you're always Secure Shelling to a Unix box. All you can do is like type command line stuff. Or I guess you could have a BT100 application. That'd be all right. There are people that sell X11 interfaces so you can secure shell and have the tunnel come back and do X11 from a Windows box. It's not that expensive. But on the other hand, if you just threw out the Windows and use Linux, then you can do the same thing without the problem. Secure shell provides reasonable coverage, but it doesn't address many of the attack methods, and we discussed that at some length throughout our discussion. Then there's HTTPS and SHTTP and SSL. Now, HTTPS is HTTP secure, whereas SHTTP is secure HTTP. Now, what's the difference between those? God awful, who knows? It's that two people designed different protocols. One of them said, I'm going to call it secure HTTP, and the other one said, well, I'm going to call mine HTTP secure. And so you just type one URL or the other, right? And so a lot of the servers automatically encrypt content if you just put an S after the HTTP. So if you just want to encrypt what you've done over the wire between you and the other device, you just put an S at the end of the HTTP and it does it for you, just like magic. And secure socket layer. And they're commonly used in web-based transactions. They provide reasonable coverage of message content, doesn't address many, many attack methods. Right? As all crypto systems, it provides some level of coverage. It's in common use, and who knows how good it is. Actually, we know some vulnerabilities. We've talked about that. More systems in use. Zip passwords are very common.
Okay. For example, almost everybody that's in the pornography industry is running on Windows, and they zip their files and they put in a zip password.
Okay, so we have a ZipCrack application that tries to guess those keys, but a little bit of analysis, we probably find a way. In fact, there's a published plain text attack against the Zip algorithm that should allow you to break it very, very quickly. So that if you think you know some part of the message, you should be able to get it real quickly. Maybe somebody who's interested in it will spend some time analyzing it because it's a very fast ZipCrack, otherwise we'll just do it by guessing. Commonly used by criminals to hide content, commonly used in long-term data storage. They zip it and they put it on a disk, and they don't want you to be able to read it without the password, they put it with a zip and a password. It's also used as a delivery mechanism. Okay? They'll take your order, they'll zip it with your order number as the key. They'll ship it to you electronically, they'll send your order number along as the decryption key. Okay, so when you unzip it, you give it the decryption key, and then it works on your system. And self-extracting zip archives. Somebody else who intercepts the transaction or picks up your missed file from somewhere, you send it to somebody else, it won't work. Encrypted disks are available in hardware since at least the 1980s, I guess probably 1970s. So you could buy a hardware device that you plug into your personal computer at that time, I guess it was a PCXT. You know, 10 million instructions per second. And no hard drive, floppy. And then they went up to, I guess, the XT. It was the PC XT that got the hard drive. That was like 5 megabyte hard drive. So pretty big. And so these encrypted disks have been around for a long time. What they do is the disk driver encrypts everything before it puts it on the disk. And it encrypts it with a key that you type in as the system boots up. So with part of the power on self-test, then it looks at the various BIOS ROMs, and one of those ROMs says, what's the key to the disk? And if you type in the key, the disk will encrypt, and if you don't, it won't. So you pull out the disk, it's of no use. You pull out the disk and the card, it's of no use without that password. Okay? That's a very reasonably effective. Usually they take a DES or a triple DES for the encryption of the disk, so I guess with enough computing power you can break it. And nowadays they have soft encryption. In fact, in Linux, the loopback interface allows you to specify an encryption system so that it'll do encryption of that loopback file system that you've mounted. So you have an image of a disk that's a file, but it's encrypted. So when you mount it, you have to give it the key, and then you can use it, but when you unmount it, it's now completely unusable for the next person that comes across. It just looks like a stew of bits, unless they can guess the key or, there should be known plain text in there, right? Like it's a disk, so the beginning of the disk is going to look like the beginning of the disk. And the EXT2 file system is going to look like the beginning of the EXT2 file system. And so there will be empty areas of the disk, right? Areas with all zeros. So look for areas with lots of zeros, and that's a known plain text. So I guess you don't want to use RSA, right? You have these big areas with all zeros, and when you take that to an exponent, it doesn't be very good. It's also slow. Application encryption, so Word, Access, Excel, and every database out there, and you name it, all sorts of people have encryption in their applications. Generally, it's Billy Bob's application encryption program. Billy Bob said, boy, I'm going to be really clever. Nobody ever figured this. I'm going to use a one-time pad. I'll XOR it with my name, Billy Bob. Because Billy Bob thinks that's a one-time pad. Okay? But of course, it's not a one-time pad because he keeps repeating it throughout the whole thing. So it's just a... What is it? It's a polyalphabetic substitution test. And it should be easy to crack with 1950s technology. So most of these application encryption systems are fairly easy to break. And there are people who access data, as an example of a company on the web that sells programs to break these encryption systems. Because the owner of the system has to be able to decrypt the data that its user encrypted. Right? You encrypted your data. You work for my business. I fired you. I can't get my data. Call Access Data, send them $29.95, $249.95, and they send you a program and it breaks it. Which then, of course, means that if I went and bought one, then I guess, oops. So so much for that encryption. That's one of the big problems with encryption, is it has to be usable. If it didn't have to be usable, we could make tremendous encryption that would never be broken. It's just fantastic. We also have infrastructure encryption, hardware encrypting modems, an Ethernet card for an example. You can now buy these for maybe a couple $100s. You can get a box that will do encryption at Ethernet speed, and it'll create a cryptographic tunnel between you and your partner out on the internet. And in fact, I guess nowadays the cable modems, the DSL and cable modems, come with encrypting firewalls, virtual private networks, built in. I know what you're asking. Oh, I was talking about the IDEA cipher. This is the IDEA cipher. Here's the code for IDEA. I forgot to pass that. There we go. Does the key automatically change every once in a while? Well, you know, every system is different. Sort of depending on what they did. You know what they did? No. Will they tell you what they did? No. Will they tell you what crypto system they used? No. It's all proprietary, but you can trust us. It's safe. Trust me. Trust me, I gave it away for free. It's carrying your critical data. And it's secure from everybody's eyes except me. Everybody. So encrypting firewalls and routers get virtual private networks secure. Network management is another thing that happens. That is, the networks, typically you manage them historically through things like RIP, the RIP routing internet protocol, whatever it is. And the RIP protocol has this minor problem that everything's done in the open, and if I watch your traffic, I can just go and change your routing tables, which means you'll send all your data to me instead of wherever it's going, and I'll forward it if I feel like it. And so we've changed over time, and we're still changing over time, to cryptographic protocols for this. But of course, there are problems with those, but it's called secure network management. And there's another thing called network security management, and that's where we use the network to manage security on all of our distant boxes. So there are big companies that sell products that have generally a centralized or hierarchical set of databases and control stations so that I can say that Joe is now a legitimate user and I would just fire Jane. And when I fire Jane, it'll go out to all the systems and remove Jane's account from all the systems automatically. And if Jane tries to use the system after that, it'll tell me in the central database and I'll be able to react to it and so forth. And those use cryptography in their infrastructure to allow them to communicate between the control mechanisms and every box on your network that's being controlled. They also enable things like single sign-on, which is you use a password once, and then wherever you are, it lets you into everywhere on the network. So no matter what box you're on, once you've authenticated yourself, you're in. Sort of like what Kerberos does in this infrastructure. So, of course, the problem with that single sign-on is that if I break any of those systems, then eventually you come across and use it, and I have all of your systems. So that's part of the nature of it. Convenience is worth a good deal. High-speed encryption device. How high speed? Well, we're moving towards petabit, optical, fiber optic telecommunications. So that's how fast encryption has to run. Right, the rule of thumb is, however fast your bits go, that's how fast the encryption has to go to keep up with it. If it can't keep up, then we can't go there. So we keep designing more and more complex and high-priced and difficult to deal with encryption mechanisms for the higher and higher speed telecommunications. Encrypted backups and restoration over networks is fairly commonplace. In fact, nowadays you can go out to the internet and have some vendor that you don't know, have never met, haven't paid anything to, use their crypto system to take all the data from your critical system, transfer it to them over the internet, where they will store it on your behalf, and of course nobody can get it. So, I guess if you trust them as much as you trust yourself, and nobody's ever broken into them, and their crypto system is sound, and their key management works, then this is about as good as doing it yourself. Public key infrastructure. There's Kerberos, all these related public key infrastructure systems that are being built over time. And then you get financial networks. Financial networks have had infrastructure encryption ever since they started doing electronic funds transfer, which was many, many years ago. So they've been encrypting certainly since the 1960s. and very successfully so, except in places like Italy and France, where they just started to do it recently. Then we have embedded encryption in disk controllers and pagers and cell phones. They now have embedded encryption for various functions, typically not very good encryption because they decided not to tell anybody about it, or that for whatever reason they decided not to try hard enough. Software products have embedded encryption. Telecommunications links now have embedded encryption. Set-top boxes and satellite dishes have embedded encryption. The set-top box is the box that sits on front of your TV if you have cable TV. And it automatically decodes, you know, the sex channel if you're getting the sex channel. Or the drugs channel, I guess, if you're getting the drugs channel. Whatever the channel is you're getting. HBO, sorry. Well, that's the sex and drugs channel. All right. But if you get violence, if you get HBO, then there's a decryption chip sitting in the set-top box that allows you to get HBO. And people now will sell you, you know, pirate set-top boxes with built-in HBO decoders, which is, of course, illegal to use, illegal to sell, because otherwise we can't protect the property rights of the people that have this content. It's their way of extracting money from you. Very important. Ethernet controllers, modems have built-in encryption. Someday in toasters and doorbells. They're talking about, you know, bringing the internet throughout your house so that your toaster calls home and says, they're making that brown toast again today, and I'm feeling so sundown of repairman to fix me. Or my refrigerators, you know. Oh, man, they put the hot soup in here again. Don't they know any better? It's tomato soup. It's going to make a mess. Come out, send the cleaning crew. I think that's the advanced technology. So, but in order to do that, of course, with safety from your home, since we don't know, want anybody to know that you had tomato soup last night, and that you were foolish enough to put hot tomato soup in a cold refrigerator out letting it cool off first, then we're going to encrypt that transaction to make you safe. All right, attacking modern, so here's how you attack modern crypto systems, except we're going to take a 7-minute break, and we'll come back after break. Okay, I almost forgot, the real reason you want to encrypt the traffic with your refrigerator is you want to make sure that somebody remotely doesn't change your refrigerator to melt everything that's in it. You know, turn your refrigerator into a toaster and your toaster into a refrigerator. And that's really the reason to encrypt it, is to prevent unauthorized modification. That is to protect its integrity. Of course, you could protect its integrity by not having it hooked up. But then you wouldn't have that advantage of having the refrigerator man show up at your door before it's broken and charge you to make sure it doesn't break or something. Attacking modern crypto systems. All right, so I have my rules of thumb for attacking modern crypto systems. So, and I'm going to go through them one at a time, and then I'm just going to mention the 50 ways to defeat your crypto systems and give you a couple examples from that, because fun and exciting. First thing is embedded encryption. What am I doing? Oh, previous instead of next. No wonder. All right, moving the right direction here. The zero with rule is that people are the weak links. Okay. So, for example, ask people their passwords. Lots of times, you know, especially in an arrest situation, you bust in the door, you got guys with guns, freeze, don't move, get on the floor, you pat them down, you stand up, and say, what's the password of that computer? And they'll say, it's JQM5L2, you have the right to remain silent. Now, what's the name of the password? You might be able to convince them it's in their best interest. Say, look, we're really looking for another guy. We need your password to do that. If we don't get your password, then you're going to be an accessory after the fact to the 47 homicide threat. And that, in California, that calls for minimum 25 years. And in a maximum security prison in the general population. So, unless you like that sort of thing, probably want to tell you about it. In other words, people write down passwords. See, you look around. And you look like on the computer, on the screen, and for the really high-powered people that really defend themselves, you look in the desk drawer. And in their wallet, and in their Palm 3s, right? If you have a Palm computer or something like that, odds are your passwords are in it, especially if you have passwords to multiple systems. And the reason is, you can't possibly remember those 473 passwords, you know? How many systems are, why is it that we use one password for all the systems? That's because otherwise I have to go breaking every time I want to do anything. More convenient than breaking it. Another one is people have habits. so use their habits against them. People, you know, use their girlfriend's name. Men use their girlfriend's name as a password. So common, it's on, or their dog, or their favorite car, Corolla, is probably a very popular password. And you thought it was a woman's name. No, it's the car. And if you were a woman and your name was Corolla, that would be really embarrassing to find out that everybody's using your name as a password. So another one is there's favorite passwords to guess, right? Like root and super user and God and various slang that we're inappropriate language in this particular forum. However, you get the idea. And there are published lists of these passwords to break things. Right? So you go look at the crack program and look at the list of standard passwords that it tries. And the reason those are the standard passwords it tries is because they work so much of the time. People can be bribed, extorted, threatened, and so forth. Now, this is normally not a legal way to get information, right? So that is, well, let's see. There's a difference between you're going to go to jail for 25 years and you know, live with Bubba. In the open prison population, that's not extortion. That's not threatening. Okay? But I have a gun. I'm going to pull the trigger. I'm going to slice your head off. That is threatening. So there's a fine line between these things. You've got to learn it. Right. So basically, threatening people isn't going to work legally, but of course, not everybody wants to get your password legally. So that if they want to break your crypto system, that's probably good. And you need to be careful and stay on the side of right. So I mean, I don't know how else to say it. You have to be a moral person to live your life and like yourself. Rule one, attack live systems. Never, ever, ever, if you can avoid it, cause the system to die. A functioning crypto system. Never stop it in order to break it. It makes it so much harder. Okay, but dead systems present far fewer vulnerabilities, like the user's not decrypting and encrypting. Right, so you don't have plain text along with ciphertext, you don't have habits of the person to observe, you don't have times of the person to observe, you can't look over the shoulder and see what their password is, you can't do any of that, because it's dead, they're not doing it. The keys in plain text may not exist. When I'm using it, I'm decrypting something so I can look at it or use it in some way, so the plain text exists, but when it's dead, there might be no plain text. And protocols can't be exploited when it's a dead system, because they're not running. Whereas live systems present many more vulnerabilities. You need to have an intelligence effort to do this, okay? So if you go busting in the door to take down some computer network, guess what? It's probably not going to be live very much longer. If you don't know that they're using encryption and you bust in the door and you're going to try and break their encryption later, it's a real pain. But if you watch, if you do the intelligence, if you do the careful planning and think and find out about it from the outside, figure out what they're doing ahead of time, then you can be properly prepared and you can come in on the sly and plant a device or some mechanism to defeat that. So the intelligence effort's important. You don't always have a choice about it, however. Okay? And when you do, choose the live system and exploit it. This is my sage wisdom. This is not a rule. This is not a mathematical proof. This is based on many foolish experiences. I was going to say, you know, the best teacher is mistakes and errors and failures. And that's why I'm such a good teacher. Because every one of these things I've done wrong. Trust me, I've done it all. Rule two, they have a way to use it. Okay? The crypto systems don't exist in some block room somewhere that nobody ever uses, nobody ever does anything with, or they wouldn't exist. They exist so other people can use it. So whatever they do to use it is the easiest way for you to get it. Okay? So they use the system by some sequence of actions related to the computer system. Observe what they do and try to repeat it. Something they have that's, you know, authentication, something you have, something you know, something you are, and I've added something you can do if you want to buy into that whole thing. So, you know, do they have a key in their pocket that they use? If you take the key from them, are you done? Have you won? Is there a PIN number associated with the key? You have to take the key and find out the PIN number in order to use it. Is there a passphrase? You know, is there a PGP passphrase? If so, can you capture it? Can you guess that it's the enter key? Because nobody wants to remember a 470 character password and they'll type it correctly every time they want to read the next email. something they are is a bit harder than something they have or something they know. Making a super hard to break system means making a super hard to use and maintain system. Okay? So it's really, really hard to break. That must mean it's really, really hard to use. And of course, nobody wants to use a system that's really, really hard to use. So there's some easy way that people have to use it. And if you catch it live, then you can do what they did, and it's easy. Most users will not tolerate hard to use systems. Rule 3, exhaustive search fails. Okay, almost every crypto system, if they've done any kind of a credible job, exhaustive search is not good enough. If the defender is really good, almost any search fails. But almost all defenders are really not all that really, really good. Most defenders are mediocre. You know, even some of the more skilled defenders make mistakes. And there's probably no defender that makes no mistakes. Because nobody's perfect. So directed search is very often a viable alternative as opposed to exhaustive search. An ordered search of the key space. Okay, so how do you do an ordered search of the key space? The order of the search is based on the users. You know, obvious guesses, names, user IDs, forwards, backwards, and so forth. Different languages present different guesses. Somebody that speaks French has different characteristics than somebody who speaks English. Okay? If they have a passphrase or some pin or something they use, that's a big lead on it. Another one is, suppose you have automatically generated keys. If you have automatically generated keys, and there's some algorithm to make those keys more usable to human beings, if you can understand what that algorithm is, that can dramatically reduce the key space that you have to search. So that changes the equation substantially. Lowest information content first is another technique. You remember we talked about Shannon's information theory and how different letters have different frequencies in the language. So you can start out with a sequence of letters that mono and bi and trigraphically produce minimum information content and work your way up with the notion that you'll get the largest number of things that sound like English language stuff first. And you'll move towards the harder to remember passwords along the way. So that can be highly effective. And dictionaries are very common to order. Key space exhaustion is sometimes feasible, but it's the hard way. The CRAC program, for example, doesn't do key space exhaustion for a long time. The first thing it does is, you know, simple words, combinations of words, dictionaries, combinations of words in the dictionary with threes for E's, and, you know, whatever those set of substitutions are. That's how it runs through the space, and that's why it's slightly better than starting with A and going to A, B, and then A, C, and then so forth. Rule 4, cryptanalysis is expensive. Okay, a good cryptographer is between $100 and $250 an hour. It often takes large teams many years to break a system. Okay, this is loaded rate. That's not what they get paid. That's what their organization is charging. Unless you have hundreds of millions of dollars in many years, cryptanalysis is not viable against strong systems. Okay, during World War II, to break the Enigma, which is considered easy by today's standards, took teams of scores of people, very, very good scientists working long hours, and they did this over a period of years to continue to break this thing. The NSA is funded, and their funding isn't published, and I don't really know what it is, but it's got to be billions of dollars a year. One of their major functions is breaking cryptosystems. Unless you want to compete with them, you don't want to do cryptanalysis of everything. Try to avoid cryptanalysis unless it's absolutely necessary. Use other weaknesses in the systems and weaknesses in the people. Rule 5. Operating systems are weaker than crypto systems. Almost any crypto system, even if it's, you know, Billy Bob system, right? Where XORs with the same 8 letters again and again and again. That's pretty tight. Whether it's easier to crack that crypto system or break into the operating system. In fact, it's probably much easier to break into the operating system because there are published operating system exploits on the internet. You go out there, you look at his web, you go to his web page, and it says I'm running, you know, Linux 5.8. Well, that doesn't exist, so it's perfect. Linux 5.8, you know he's lying, he goes somewhere else. It's running Linux, you know, 5.2. You go to the Linux exploit page, pick up Linux 5.2 external exploit, run it against the box, say, oh, you're in. Fine, you put in a keyboard sniffing thing and have it transmit it all to you at your convenience, and you win. observe their screen, you know, using X11 output, you can just put the X11 from their screen directly onto your screen, watch everything, no problem. Crypto systems is easy. Look for deleted files. This is if you're in a forensic situation. Look for deleted files in Slack space. Places where they might have the information that you're looking for without having it in an encrypted form. Cache areas and paging areas. Look for the plain text file. Lots of people encrypt something for transmission, but keep the plain text file sitting around. Look for the passwords in files. People throw their passwords in files. Maybe it's a backup to their Palm 3 that's on their PC that has their password. Right? It's in there. Plant a bug in the operating system and exploit it in real time. Collect keystroke information. Put a Trojan in the encryption and decryption program. Hey, they have Netscape. Son of a gun, I'll put a Trojan into Netscape so when it says it's going SSL, it makes the lock on the key look like it's locked, but it's not. It's just a change in the graphic. It looks like you're in secure mode, but we're watching everything through the browser. It's a simple matter, much simpler than trying to break the crypto system. And I'm sure that you can think of many more like that. So take a look before you go doing crypto analysis. Protocols are also weaker than the cryptographic transforms. Many public cryptographic transforms are pretty hard to break today, but most such systems run over protocols that have weaknesses. At a minimum, they run over protocols that haven't been well verified, the vast majority of them. Find the protocol weakness, covert channels, key exchanges, man-in-the-middle attack, crypto negotiations, or use reflexive control, okay? That is, cause their crypto system to reset, you know, send that reset packet out just as they've established their connection, and pretty soon they'll just give up on the crypto because the system's not functional. And their reflex, they need to get business done, crypto isn't working, send it in the queue. You might want to read, this one's on the web at all.net. You can go to all.net, click on 50 Ways series, click on 50 Ways to defeat your PKI and other crypto systems, and you'll get this. That's the paper copy. I just thought I'd read a couple of them to give you a sense here. PKI is public key infrastructure. Flood the public key infrastructure with fictitious user IDs and names. Okay. The net effect is that any typo gets the user one of your prepositioned keys. So if they make a typo in typing the name of the person they're talking to, they get you instead of the person that they're talking to. You then decrypt their messages and forward them encrypted to the intended recipient. Another way to have a man-in-the-middle attack, but I've done it by making it so that a typo makes them talk to me when they think they're talking to you. Interrupt traffic every 10 or 20 packets by sending a reset packet to the session. Since PKI uses private key encryption for high-volume transmission, it depends heavily on synchronization for its proper operation. Every time you desynchronize the private key system, new public key exchanges have to be made to get a new private key at the overhead of lots of computer time and exchange bits, and so it will rapidly become unusable. Buy a new phony public key every few hours and send viruses with them all. That gets around, you know, these authenticated programs. Revoke the key of a user who's still using their key. They'll have to re-register again and again and confuse the whole system over time. There's lots of these are, so enjoy, read the paper, go to the web. So. All right. Finally, last topic is steganography. I want to talk a little bit about the history and present situation in steganography and how you defeat it. There's classic steganography is you photograph a document, you photographically reduce it to a micro dot, you place a micro dot on the document as a period or a dot on an I, you send it in the mail, the recipient removes the micro dot, the recipient photographically blows up the micro dot, and the recipient reads the document. That's standard classic steganography. And there are various ways of doing it. Here are some classics of steganography. World War II, the photographic techniques like the one I just said. Another example is after that there was a US POW, I believe it was in Vietnam, that was being tortured into making a confession, basically saying the US was bad and so forth. Had the presence of mind and somehow the mental acuity, which is beyond belief in a situation like this, that when he was beaten and so forth, and he's on Vietnamese TV, he's blinking his eyes in Morse code. I'm serious. And the Morse code of the blinking of his eyes came out to torture him. Okay? Yeah. Now, of course, they didn't reveal it on TV right away until he was free. but they knew that he was being tortured. And that was why he was saying these things. Okay, so, amazing, isn't it? The use of microwriting on credit cards.
You guys have a credit card? Anybody here have a credit card?
There's microwriting on your credit card.
Okay,
on a Visa, if you look around the word Visa, around that logo, if you look closely, there are little letters. That's not a solid bar around there. That's a whole bunch of little letters. And you, if you look closely, which I can't do because my eyes don't work that good anymore, you can actually read all the words there on your Visa card. So that's a sort of a steganographic mechanism. It's very small. That's a steganographic mechanism to make it more difficult to forge. It's a watermark. So the GIF and JPEG images are used to encode secret messages of hate groups in the United States. Hate groups communicating with each other have logos and other things that they send around. And read what it says. Okay? But it's really hard to see. I mean, let's see. You have a new dollar bill. Let's see if I have a new dollar. Here's a new 20. And the new 20s, if you remember when they published the security precautions about the new 20s, there's a strip, if this is a valid one.
Yes, there it is.
There's a strip that runs through it right along here, and it has printing in it. And that's an example. There's a magnetic thing, there's a fiber, and so on. Those are essentially steganographic techniques. Okay. They're used there. It's a watermarking mechanism to make it harder to forge these. Now I guess they have pens, too. And watermarking is now a common technique using steganography to detect copyright frauds. Like when you get a movie, a DVD, it's got steganography in it. You can't see it when it shows, but if somebody duplicates your DVD, then they'll be able to track it down to the lot and the volume and who it was sold to and through and so on. And if they really did it right, then your credit card purchase would tie it to you. And they would know that was you. You bought the DVD, and it's your copy of the movie that's out of the market. So guilty already? No, not at all. Okay, well, you know, that's how it is. Now, this graphic was really good. This is a beautiful looking graphic. If you look at it on a display screen, but up on this thing up here, it's hard to see. This is a Microsoft. I took a Microsoft, one of their photographs from Microsoft PowerPoint of this blue surface with droplets of water and light reflecting on it. And if you look carefully at these two, and how carefully is the question, that looks pretty darn. If you go down to the dot level and look real carefully, you will see that there are a couple of bits different in this one than that. In fact, in this one over here on the, I think, which one is it? This one on the right, I'm pretty sure. This one on the right, I've actually written letters with sets of black dots on top of the picture. But if you look at that picture, full resolution on a big, beautiful display, you can't see it. Okay? It's just microwriting. So a lot of people put digital steganography into photographs because there's a lot of information content and the eye can't tell the difference between the steganographically encoded one and the other. So there are various ways that this content is added in a form that's not easily recognized. For example, in text, they add spaces, or they use spaces or tabs. They might change the tab stops or the spacing associated with a C program. Steganographically encoded is their C program. So the view uses their segment of code, and they have space, tab before the third line, and space, tab before the fifth line in their program. That's a pattern they can look for to detect your theft of their work, your use of their code. Which is why whenever I steal code for anybody, I always reformat it all. So, that gets rid of that. Another one is the words they use for variable names. You can transform a program by changing the variable name, and that will steganographically encode it with some message. End of line. The end of the line has a space or more spaces, or whether it has a space or not, that can be used. in a text to encode a message. The addition of extra lines, alternative spelling of words, and alternative word usage. Just use synonyms to do psychographic content. Images are much more content rich and much more difficult to tell the difference in. So they typically use low order bits, right? If you have an 8-bit blue, 8-bit red, and 8-bit green in a picture, and I change the low order bit, it's not going to change the color very much. It will be undetectable to the human eye, a 1-bit change. Now, of course, if it's one of these systems that has the color encoding, that 1-bit change might change red to black because of the way the color planes work. But if you're careful about how you encode it, that works very well. So they do this generally in bitmap. BMP files are a good place because they're fully blown up and they have lots of content and so forth. And they're displayed in a different way. They use compression. They might use shading to change the gray values associated with parts of the picture. Edge lines. Okay, you have an edge line around the face where the face breaks into the background. And you can just sort of make little changes in the jaggedness of that edge. Change the smoothness of that edge or the rate of change from one color to the other around that edge. And it's a very nice way to encode information. Reflections. You have a droplet with a reflection of the sun and you encode something in that reflection. And because especially digitized images, that reflections have problems because of resolution. Using that deviation of resolution, you can encode a substantial amount of information. And so forth. Lots and lots and lots of ways to do this. How do you detect it? Turns out different file types lead to different schemes. Okay? For example, files are in a language. You can think of a file as being in a language with characteristics. So if you get one of these things that you get with PowerPoint, one of these images, that's it's a graphic, what do they call this? It's not the file, clip art, right? Clip art typically is done in such a way that there are very crisp lines between things, so that there are clear stair-stepping, there are not a small number of colors, so it'll work on a lot of different schemes and work effectively. And where it's white, it's white. It's not different shades of gray like a real photograph. So if you look at the bit level at clip art, you can usually tell that it's supposed to be clip art, but it's got something encoded in it, just because it's not real clean. Because clip art is very clean artistically. Clean lines, very clear background. If there's a shading gradation, it's very even shading gradation, because it was generated by a computer algorithm. You can reproduce the algorithm and see whether the algorithm will produce that. Whereas if it's steganographically encoded, it'll be hard to make an algorithm that does it. It'll look like there's some randomness in it. Files in the language, C programs. Okay, you look at a C program, there are some very stylistic automation for encoding C programs, for example, in various editors. So if those editors automate that formatting, then you can tell the deviations from that automated formatting. If you look at my code, I have a style of writing. And if you see deviations from that style of writing, that's probably steganographic content. And so forth. JPEG and GIF have various characteristics. Photographs have characteristics. Okay? A photograph taken in a certain light level with a certain kind of camera has certain characteristics of the way things work. Certain kinds of averaging and shading and so forth. And so if you go in and look at it with steganographic content and compare it to the other one, you can see these changes in characteristics. And that's how you can use that to detect steganography. Analyze the characteristics of the file, information content. Unexpected syntax is another syntax in the language we're talking about. That's a syntax difference to see that the edge lines aren't clean in clip art. Okay, it means it's a different language that's embedded in it. And the steganographic technique. So yeah, if you know, somehow the stego system detects the presence of its steganography for its decoding purposes. So if you can understand a list of known steganographic techniques, you can look for how each of them marks their keys or marks the presence of the steganography or how it places the steganography in there and so forth. So these are all giveaways to tell you not only that it has steganography, but what schema it was using. least they're indicated. Example of bitmap image of the face tends to have certain characteristics. All right, and it's likely detectable if they're altered. If faces have, if you look closely, wrinkles and other stuff, and at the digital level, those get aliased in certain ways. And the aliasing will be different if there's steganography than if there isn't. So your eye won't see the difference, but a detailed analysis might be able to detect it. Breaking steganography is like breaking cryptography. You start by trying to identify the system, you cryptanalyze the system, which is often easy in steganography, because they haven't used sound crypto techniques, or you know, the best cryptographers haven't spent years figuring out whether this watermarking scheme is repeatable. Avoid the system. Get the data with other means. Disable the system. For example, if you're trying to screw up a steganographic system that's being used to communicate, stick your own steganography into the images being sent back and forth. Okay? And when they get it, they won't be able to read their stego, but your stego is over top. Okay. You take whatever the C program it is and you run it through a C code, you know, regenerator that formats the C code. So whatever they had in it, it's gone now. It's been reformatted. Same C code. Of course, it depends on what they've done, right? If they've used variable names. So you can do the same thing to variables. You can automatically transform variable names. Of course, you may lose a lot of your sense of what the program does when the thing that used to be called, you know, buffer zone A is now called LMQ5NBY. For some reason, reading that program becomes more difficult. I don't understand. You can defeat the system, alter the transform to your advantage. So you take their stego, you break into their system, you cause their stego to use some transform that you know how to defeat, or cause it to plant the key automatically as part of the steganography in the place that you've chosen. It'll look to them like it's working, it'll still function right, but you're reading all their messages. You can forge them. Just like cryptography. Right? It's the same game. They combine steganography and cryptography together in some cases. So when cryptography is used with stego, that means we're using deception in the form of steganography, secret writing in the form of cryptography, and that enhances security through the enhancement of obscurity. Not that it's unbreakable, it's that they've obscured it more and more. So what can happen here is you get sequences of encryption, embedding, or compression with a message and a carrier. Like steganography has a carrier signal, a picture that you're embedding the message in, and a message content that's being embedded in that carrier. So you can encrypt the carrier, then embed the stego, then compress it, or you can compress the message and then compress the carrier and then embed and then encrypt. Or, you know, any sequence of these can happen. And the question, one of the good questions here for using these together is what should you do first in what circumstances? And it's a question that hasn't been answered as far as I know in the literature yet. So,